I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Greg Mortensen is back. He wrote the book Three Cups of Tea about building schools in Afghanistan. And it turns out now he's advising the military. We're going to speak with him in a few minutes. But first, President Obama takes his economic recovery plan to the people in rallies around the country today and tomorrow and at a primetime news conference tonight. It's a tactic that he hopes will push the plan over the top in Congress, where it had no Republican support in the House, and where tomorrow senators are expected to narrowly pass an $827 billion version after three moderate Republicans shaved off some government spending. The battle for the stimulus plan is so pitched, it's pushed the administration's plan to save the banks off the agenda until tomorrow. Greg Ipp is U.S. economics editor at The Economist magazine. He joins us from The Economist studios in Washington. And Greg, you write that on many issues, Obama's centrist advisors are competing for his ear while his party is trying to drag him back to the left. So who's winning this back and forth in the stimulus plan?
Well, Robin, we'll have to wait till we see what finally gets passed. But you can certainly see in the package, even as it's been modified in the Senate, elements of Obama's and his party's initial priorities, which were to extend tax relief more into the lower and middle income classes and to expand health care. Both through additional funding to the states through Medicaid, and, for example, by providing for the first time subsidies to the unemployed to maintain their private health care. Now, that said, as it's moved on through the political process, it's been tilted a little bit back in the direction of, for example, more tax cuts that could also be beneficial to those in the upper income classes.
Well, this is boiling down to the core argument. Many Republicans primarily saying it's tax cuts and relief for Americans that will stimulate the economy. And most Democrats and a lot of economists saying, no, it's spending, spending, spending. This seems to be the core argument. And Paul Krugman says that this has been a real, slip for President Obama, that he's relented too much to the tax cutters, and that, for instance, $80 billion cut from school construction and aid for the unemployed would have stimulated the economy the most.
Well, there's still, even after those cuts, a lot of spending in this stimulus bill, a lot of money for Medicaid, a lot of money for infrastructure. And it's true that when you put more of that money to tax cuts, you do tend to get less stimulus. For example, a dollar of spending could give you a dollar to $2.50 on GDP, whereas on tax cuts, because some of that money will be saved, you don't tend to get as much oomph from it. But look, this is the hard business of governing, and it's important to Obama that this thing get passed one way or another. And the practical reality is that if he can't get some Republicans to sign on to it in the Senate, the stimulus will not become law.
Well, we're going to be hearing from some mayors later in the program of the cities that President Obama is visiting, and they're saying they're for the stimulus and they want the money right now. So we'll hear from them in a moment. But just as an aside, isn't this sort of a win-win for the Republicans, because they seem to have captured something in the ether? People very much worried, Americans worried about, deficit spending. So they get to complain about the spending and be on record doing that, and yet their states will still get the money.
Well, yes, I think it's both tactically and strategically clever in a certain way, because I think that a lot of the Republicans have taken the attitude that, well, whatever our philosophical differences or agreements with the administration on this particular stimulus package, the fact of the matter is it may not work. The economy may continue to get worse. And if it doesn't, we can be the ones who say, we told you so. On the other hand, if it does work, there's probably not too many voters who will remember that Republicans voted against it or punish them for it.
And Greg, if we just have about a minute left, but I do want to touch on Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner's bank rescue plan. It's due out tomorrow. It's kind of a hybrid. Is there a central idea?
I would say that the central idea of it is to not have a central idea, because I think the mistake Paulson made was to lay down the law, no, we're going to do it this way with mortgage purchases, and then completely shift and say we're going to put capital into the banks, and that was bad for investor confidence. Geithner will take a multi-pronged approach, both purchasing mortgages, modifying mortgages, setting up a bad bank with private sector participation to buy some of those mortgages, and additional capital for the banks.
Okay, and the thinking is up to $3 trillion may ultimately be needed to fix those banks. That's a lot of money.
Yes, it sure is.
Greg Ipp, economics editor at The Economist magazine. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, we know the classic economic debate, guns versus butter, how much a society should spend on the military needs versus civilian ones like schools and roads. Greg Mortensen has his own version of that debate. It's books versus bombs, or as he puts it, peace through literacy. And he knows which one wins hands down in his view. Many of you know Mortensen. He's author of the mega bestseller Three Cups of Tea, which tells the story of how, in attempting and failing to climb K2, one of the highest Himalayan peaks, Greg stumbled, lost in the mountains, into the Pakistani village of Corfe, and into a new life as a builder of schools. After the villagers of Corfe nursed him back to health, he returned to build their school and has gone on to build 78 more in Pakistan and Afghanistan, serving 28,000 kids with more schools and refugee centers in the region. And it turns out he's done so well that he's now caught the eye of and is now advising the U.S. military, just as the Obama administration is increasing troop levels in Afghanistan. Greg Mortensen joins us in the studio. And, Greg, I don't know how. I don't know if you have the time. So welcome back to Here and Now.
Hi, Robin. Good to see you.
It's so good to see you. Let's go to the end of your story first. What is the government asking you, and what are you telling them?
Well, about a year and a half ago, I started getting contacted by the U.S. military. A lot of military wives are actually reading the book and telling their husbands to check it out. I got an email from General Petraeus, who's our CENTCOM commander. He said he had read Three Cups of Tea, and he sent me three bullet points. This is what he learned from the book. Number one, build relationships. Number two, have respect. And number three, that we need to listen to people. We need to listen. In many ways, our military commanders, they've been in Afghanistan three or four times, and they really get it that what is most important is to build relationships. So mostly what I talk about, I do this all as a volunteer. I'm not getting paid or anything, to tell them about cultural sensitivity and also about the significance of what education can do. I'll quote to you an Army colonel. His name is Colonel Kalenda, commander of the forward operating base in Kunar province in Afghanistan. He says that ultimately this is a war that will not be won with bombs and bullets, but with books and ideas that excite the imagination towards peace, tolerance, and prosperity.
It's so funny you mention Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Kalenda, who works on the front lines there in Afghanistan, because I was just picking up a paper with a quote from him in which he raves about your book and your work. And he also says, I'm convinced the long-term solution to terrorism in general and Afghanistan especially is education. You are getting all of these accolades, all of these office doors in Washington opening to you. You're very modest, so I'll say it. Several congressmen have nominated you for the Nobel Peace Prize for the work that you've done. And yet, Greg, we understand the Obama administration is planning a sharp troop increase in Afghanistan and also switching their strategy from butter to guns, from reconstruction and rebuilding to fighting the Taliban.
President Obama is actually already in the process of rapidly deploying three brigades to Afghanistan, 20 to 30,000 troops, so which is about 60% increase in our troop strength. I've talked to our top military commanders, spent a lot of time with them, and even they will tell you there is no military solution in Afghanistan. That's absolutely not possible. What I think our administration is thinking about is what I call firepower. But if you talk to our military leaders, they say the people there need brain power. And brain power means training, supplies for their army, for their police, but mostly education. And also having met with President Karzai, their top military commanders in Afghanistan, their militia leaders, their Islamic leaders, they will all say, we do not need more U.S. troops in Afghanistan. What we need is training, supplies, and we need education. So my concern is that Obama has rather brazenly announced this without consulting with the Afghan people first. On the other hand, our military leaders, like, say, Admiral Mike Mullen, Eric Olson, who's a Special Forces commander, and General Petraeus, the three of them combined have been to Pakistan, Afghanistan about 20 times in the last 10 months. What they are doing is they're drinking tea, as in my case, and they're meeting with the people, they're listening to them, and that's really the key to, I think, peace.
Explain what the drinking tea analogy is, because you had a lot of setbacks in your dream of building schools because you didn't understand what the need really was. And in that first town I mentioned, Corfe, after they nursed you back to health, you came home, you desperately tried to raise the money, you sent out over 500 fundraising letters, you got one check back from Tom Brokaw, you finally got some money to go build them a school. And you get all the equipment and you get over the mountain passes and you've got all of this stuff to build a school for them, and they greet you and say, but what we really need is a bridge.
Well, Haji Ali was a village chief in a village in northern Pakistan, and he told me once, I'd spent 3 years trying to get a school built, and my problem was I was doing something that we call micromanagement. I had my plumb line receipts, and I was determined to get this school built. One day, Haji Ali took me aside. He said, if you want to do business here, you need to have three cups of tea. First cup, you're a stranger. Second cup, a friend. And third cup, your family. What he was meaning is that it's important to build relationships. And not only that, he took my plumb line receipts and records. He locked them up. He came back and said, there, everything will be fine. Don't you worry.
This is all the equipment you had bought, your plumb line and,
right,
and all the receipts and everything to build the school. He finally took them away from you, and you panicked.
I panicked. And guess what happened? 6 weeks later, the school got built. And it was an important lesson to let go and empower the communities. And that is kind of the key to all our schools now. We provide skilled labor, material, and teacher training, but they provide free land, free resources, free wood, and free sweat equity. And that's on a micro scale, but you can also apply this on a macro scale. One of my main criticisms about the reconstruction policy in Afghanistan until recently is that it was primarily centralized and deprovincialized. And if you look back in history at the Marshall Plan was provincialized and decentralized. And so in Afghanistan, until recently, we completely flipped that around. And only recently have we really started to realize about empowering provincial areas. And basically, I call it bottoms-up type of development.
Well, Greg Mortensen, it sounds like I'm hearing you say a couple of important things here. One is that there seems to be a disconnect. You're hearing from people in the military, gee, we're really on board with what this Mortensen guy is saying. We need to build these schools. This is the way we need to go. And yet we're hearing from the Obama administration they're going to pull back from reconstruction and attack the Taliban. But you're also saying that when there is reconstruction through the military, it tends to be without involving the people who actually are going to use facilities like schools. So let's address each of those. The Taliban has been so resurgent. Don't you have to tamp down the Taliban first before you can build schools?
Well, certainly there's need for security. There's need to secure areas. There are two things going on. One is that the Taliban have bombed, destroyed, or shut down over 500 schools in Afghanistan, another 180 schools in Pakistan. But nearly all those schools are girls' schools. And I think the real reason they're attacking girls' schools and not boys' schools is because their greatest fear, it's not the bullet, but it's the pen. And what they fear most is if that girl grows up, gets an education, they've lost their ability to get recruits. In the Quran, it mentions that when someone goes on jihad, they first have to get permission from their mother. And if they don't, it's very disgraceful. If a woman has an education, she's much less likely to condone her son to get into violence or terrorism. On the other hand, this is something I find very incredible, is that there are today over 7 million children in school in Afghanistan. 2 million are female. And in 2000, 8 years ago, there's only 800,000, mostly boys, in school. It's the largest increase in school enrollment in any country in modern history, and nobody in the U.S. is aware of it.
Well, and we saw the report of the Afghan girls attacked by the Taliban, and they had acid thrown in their faces, and they went back to school. Incredible. You know, we want to hear more about what Greg feels is so important, the education of girls, and we want to hear what the military is saying to Greg about this. Greg Mortensen, of course, co-author of Three Cups of Tea. Also later, a shimmering new novel about a real-life massacre in Korea and its effect on a fictional West Virginia town. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Greg Mortensen, co-author of the mega bestseller Three Cups of Tea, the book about his failed attempt to climb one of the highest Himalayan peaks, his rescue by Pakistani villagers, and how he came back to the region to build schools for them and others. The story has caught Washington's attention. Greg's now advising the U.S. military, making the argument for more schools, not more soldiers, in Afghanistan. Just before the break, though, Greg, we were talking about how the Taliban has been destroying schools, attacking girls. Doesn't that mean that we need the military to tamp down the Taliban so schools can work?
In some areas, obviously, the military is going to have to take on the Taliban. But, for example, the way we get girls' schools started in Taliban areas is we work many years building relationships. We also meet with the Taliban in some cases. And we have former Taliban who now are teachers in our schools. And they are our greatest advocates for education. And all of them got out of the Taliban because their mother said, what you're doing is not a good thing. And they're at risk for their life. They're on a hit list. But they're willing to be advocates for education. And what happens is when a school is destroyed, it's often written off the government records. But if you go back there 6 months, 1 year later, you'll still see the girls outside or in secrecy trying to go to school. And unfortunately, nobody's really supporting that effort. The girls themselves, their communities, they value education. And that's what I find everywhere I go in rural Pakistan, Afghanistan. People really, really want education.
In fact, the New York Times has an anecdote about an attack, an anti-American mob in Baharak, Afghanistan, rampaging through but stopping at the school. I think you built that school.
Yeah, we built a school in Baharak in northern Afghanistan on May 13th, Friday the 13th, 2005. The story came out with Newsweek that there was an alleged story of a Quran being flushed in the toilet in Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. And riots erupted and ensued everywhere, and Baharak was no exception. About 2,000 men went down the streets after Juma Friday prayers. They destroyed every single NGO office, the Land Cruisers, their computers. And the last school in the end of the bazaar, 2 miles down the road, was our beautiful brand new school with fresh green lime paint, fresh window panes. I mean, it was like the perfect target. And when they got there, the peer, who the elders, they said, you know, this is our school, and if anybody throws a stone here, we're going to kill you, and because this school belongs to us. And again, it's the local
ownership. But Greg, I want to ask you about your work with the military. You're an NGO, and I know other NGOs, non-governmental organizations, have been critical of you for getting too close to the military. There's a fear that, you know, unarmed aid workers, if too closely associated with the military, will be endangered in the field. What do you say to that criticism?
Well, I'll meet with anybody. Anybody wants to talk about how to get education going, whether it's the Taliban, the U.S. military, government officials. We do collaborate also with a lot of NGOs. We also are very clear we have never received $1 of U.S. federal funding.
Even though you've had some pretty big offers. You were at a military meeting, and what happened?
Well, I've been offered money several times by the USAID or the Pentagon. In fact, one time they offered to give us over $2 million, which is a huge amount of money. And I said, well, I don't want it knowing where we wouldn't want the source to know. And they said, well, we could stage a fictitious donor from Hong Kong, and you could write him a thank you. But we politely declined the offer. But I think it's important, especially with girls' education, the impact of that does not happen for one or two generations. But some other things that happen with girls' education is the infant mortality drops. The number of live births per female decreases substantially over one generation. The population explosion drops. And Amartya Sen, who's here in Boston,
the Nobel
Harvard,
Prize winner, yep.
He says that investing in girls' education is the single most important investment you can make in a society. Just from my own perspective, too, I see girls, they come home from the marketplace with meat or vegetables wrapped in newspaper, and then their mother very carefully unfolds a newspaper and asks them to read the news to her. Also, you'll see girls writing letters to their mother, to their family, because often their maternal ties are severed. And again, what I was mentioning is that women are much less likely to condone their son to get into violence or terrorism if they do have an education. Yeah. Also, you know, why not let the Taliban be a political entity? They would lose their clout very quickly.
So another of your suggestions is to let the Taliban run as a political party and move them from maybe a violent insurgent group. But also, what? To staying with the schools, what would you like to see the military do, the military that you're now advising? Should it be the military that takes your model and works with villagers to help them build their own schools?
Well, I don't think the military should be directly hands-on building schools. I think people perceive the military as, you know, soldiers and security, and there should be some differentiation between humanitarian workers and soldiers. On the other hand, in many areas now in Afghanistan, there is no NGOs working there anymore. There is very few aid workers, and so it's just the military and then a few crazy people like us who are going in those areas. I think military is going to be in Afghanistan at least 10 more years. And what's happening is the number of girls going up in school, and over time that'll help stabilize the region more. And the immediate solution, though, is not an immediate deployment of 20 or 30,000 Marines troops. That'll only escalate the violence. The real enemy, it's ignorance, and it's ignorance that breeds hatred. and overcome that, I think we need to have courage and compassion, but most of all, I think education is the key.
Greg Mortensen, again, co-author of the bestseller Three Cups of Tea, now out in paperback, along with two new editions for kids and young readers. You can find out much more about it at our website, here-now.org. And by the way, Greg, through one of the books, the one for young teens, we hear a lot from your daughter, Amira, and she's just become quite an advocate for her new young friends in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
There was a question asked of her, so how does it feel when your dad leaves to go overseas for several months to Afghanistan or Pakistan? She says, well, first we wake up and we're sad. Then we go to the airport. We cry a bit, but not a ton. Then we go to school. And then we get happier during the day because we know when we get home, Daddy will be there because he missed his flight. And then the next day is a lot worse.
Well,
that's true.
Again, Greg Mortensen, thanks so much for coming in and spending some time with us.
Well, thanks, Robin.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, the death of a promising young doctor in Boston offers a glimpse into the problem of drug abuse among anesthesiologists. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, two mayors say, give me the money. After the news, Here and Now. So what are those so-called shovel-ready projects that towns across the country want federal money to fund? President Obama will hear for himself this week as he hits the road stumping for his stimulus package. His first stop is the northern Indiana city of Elkhart, population 53,000, where unemployment is the highest in the country at more than 15%. And then tomorrow, the president heads to Fort Myers, Florida, a region known as the foreclosure capital of America. Well, we've got mayors from both areas on the line. Mayor Dick Moore of Elkhart, Indiana. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
And also joining us, Jim Birch, mayor of Cape Coral, Florida, just across the Caloosahatchee River?
Caloosahatchee.
From Fort Myers. Mayor Birch, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And Mayor Moore, let's start with you. Elkhart, formerly known as the RV capital of the world. Just last month, RV manufacturers announced hundreds of layoffs. We know the number, that you have this huge unemployment, but describe how you feel that in your town.
It's very stressed. There's no doubt about it. We are very economically depressed here. Actually, the number, you said you know the number, but about one out of every six of our workforce in our city is currently out of a job. So Elkhart is the city with a heart, and there's many people doing a lot of things for other people right now, and we will prevail, but we need some help, and we're very, very pleased, and it's very uplifting for us to have the president here today. And it'll be a morale booster. There's no doubt about that. We can't wait to hear from him.
In reading about what's happening in your town, I'm also reading the comments that people have sent in online. And people are very angry. People writing that Elkhart has been drowning for years in its continued dependence on the RV industry. The dropout rate for schools in the surrounding counties is high. Why wasn't there more of an investment in education? What do you say to those people who are saying, you know, much like they're saying to Detroit, you put too many of your eggs in one basket?
Well, I think when times are good, and times have been very good here with that industry, the jobs have been good-paying jobs, the benefits have been good. So when times are good, you don't think about anything else, and perhaps that's something that we should have done a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But there is absolutely no doubt that we should diversify and that we probably should have looked at a long time ago.
Okay, well, Mayor Birch, turning to you, Mayor of Cape Coral, Florida, try to explain to us what foreclosure feels like in your town.
It feels like somebody hit you in the stomach. We have probably about 10,000 foreclosures in the past 18 months. We have a lot of homes that people bought to flip the property, as they say nowadays, for resale. And, of course, when the musical chairs stopped, people got caught holding some of these properties. So now we have basically a lot of maintenance issues, safety issues.
Well, let's talk about that, because we know, I mean, the values of the homes have dropped 70%. That's tough for tax base and everything. But we also understand it's you, the city government, that has to mow the lawns, pull the weeds, drain the swimming pools.
That's right, Robin. And in fact, we have many, many homes with swimming pools. Well, it doesn't take long before they turn green instead of blue. And so we board those up. We board the houses up. We cut the grass. And those are things we've taken on ourselves. And that certainly is stressing our budget as well.
Well, we know that both of you, are like mayors across the country, are really hoping for a stimulus package that will funnel money to your town. Mayor Birch, what would you do?
For us, it's very, very simple. We have several things that are, you know, shovel-ready, as they say. Number one, we have a state-of-the-art utility expansion system underway. We have done approximately half of our city.
We understand that you had to stop because the city ran out of funds, and when you stopped, you lost, what, 1,000 jobs?
That's about right. We lost about 1,000 jobs, and we hope to put those back out there. In fact, you know, if we, you know, we have started looking at putting water, the water utility in only, and you know, we're considering that. We're also looking at the stimulus, you know, funds, maybe having that come in before we do that, so we don't jeopardize those projects. But this kind of an infrastructure program, it does indeed create jobs. It does create places for people to come and spend their money.
That's Jim Birch there in Cape Coral, Florida, making his impassioned pitch for a stimulus package money to come to his city. Mayor Dick Moore, I know you feel just as passionate. What are your shovel-ready projects?
We have 17 projects ready to go. We go to bid within 30 to 60 days. They are shovel-ready. They total $92.4 million. And we have a railroad overpass that's badly needed. Top of our list is our combined sewer overflow problems that we have here.
And what jobs would come from getting those projects
started? About 2,300 jobs is what we're predicting.
Yeah. So here you are, both of you, sitting, waiting, wishing for money. What do you think, though, about the debate that's going on? In particular, Mayor Birch there in Florida, your representative, Connie Mack, has voted against the stimulus package. He says spending isn't the way out of this problem. Tax cuts are.
You know, Robin, I'd say this. You know, I think there's certainly people on both sides of the aisle, on both sides of the fence, that say, you know, do you put the money in local government's hands or do you try with tax cuts? I'm not one that ever subscribed to a trickle-down theory. It didn't seem to me to work in the past, and I am certainly one to subscribe to the fact that local governments know what to do with the money. I can tell you right now, somebody comes to my office and says, Jim, here's $350 million for you to finish your entire utility infrastructure. How are you going to do it, and when are you going to do it? I'm going to say I'm going to start in 3 weeks. We're going to start then. We're going to move on, and we will put thousands of people to work.
Mayor Birch, I'm going to ask you the same thing I asked of Mayor Moore. I mean, people are saying $350 million, that's a lot of money for one city. And what will you do in return to promise the taxpayers that, for instance, there won't be that same kind of real estate engine that seems to be driven there where people were flipping homes? Or, I mean, what can you do to guarantee that you won't have that same kind of problem?
What the city can do is target areas in the city to make sure that we have a good, healthy mix of commercial to residential. Right now, we're at commercial at 13%. We need to be at about 25%. So we need to work on that, and we are, in fact, doing that. As far as monitoring how flipping goes or speculating goes.
Loans are made to people who may not be able to afford them.
Correct. And I think that's something that the banks, the real estate people, and the mortgage companies, certainly they're going to do better now than they did. In the last 4 or 5 years, I can tell you, I've seen people that bought houses like they were buying a hamburger. I mean, it was like 30 days later they had a house that was $500,000. And, you know, a little common sense, I think, comes there. I don't know that the city can do anything about that.
And Mayor Moore, there in Elkhart, Indiana, with the RV industry sinking, and you've said that you want to diversify. What can you tell American taxpayers that you'll do with stimulus money that won't land you back as a city that's dependent on one industry that, you know, isn't doing very well?
I have one fear about the stimulus package. I believe it will pass. I believe we'll get some money. But the money should come directly back here. We're ready to go. We're ready to put these people to work. My fear is that it will be sent to other agencies within our state, and then there'll be delays and more red tape and more requirements and hurdles and hoops that we have to jump through and over, and there will be a delay, and the true meaning of stimulus will be lost. For us here, it's jobs, as I said before. We must create jobs. We'd like to establish a high-tech park next door to us at Notre Dame. Nanotechnology has moved in there. We'd like to have a little of that, too, so we're looking for the high-tech stuff in the future. We need to get the standard of living up, and the way we're going to do that is to bring in some jobs that pay more money. I think we've learned a lesson, and we need to diversify here, and we will.
Robin, we just need a little stimulus. That's all it is. Give us 12 to 18 months worth of stimulus and help us with our infrastructure. My goodness, we have it all ready to go. We just need a little help, and I'm hoping that President Obama tomorrow will talk with me and we'll be able to get that help that we need.
That's Jim Birch, Mayor of Cape Coral, Florida. We've also been speaking with Mayor Dick Moore of Elkhart, Indiana. The president is touching down in his town today. Mr. Mayor, thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. And it was nice speaking with you as well, Mayor Moore.
Same here, Mayor. Thank you.
Embattled mayors. Well, just a reminder, you can listen to our show stream live at our website, here-now.org. And for past programs, just click on the archives. Although we are a little bit under construction right now, so you might take a little more time. You can also download a podcast. That's at here-now.org. In a couple of minutes, a quick thought on Coldplay. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, we just heard two mayors talking about layoffs. Job loss is the worst it's been in over 30 years. It's no surprise that outplacement firms are doing a booming business. These are the firms hired by companies to help their laid-off employees find new jobs. But what about people who lose their jobs and don't have that help? Well, into that void come the new social media and networking sites like LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Here Now's Kurt Nickisch reports on a Massachusetts man who's tapping into this explosion of online networking to get back to work.
It was November when Dave Atkins of Westwood got a phone call from his boss. There was going to be a company meeting. Half the people at a small internet startup were going to lose their jobs.
I happened to be on Twitter at the time. I sent a message to a guy I know, and I said, hey, it looks like I'm getting laid off. He wrote back and said, oh, really? Well, I know of a position maybe at this company. And immediately, people started looking for ways to help me.
That prospect didn't pan out. But the point is, even before Atkins had a pink slip in his hand, he was clicking away to find his next job. He blogged about it right away.
So I wrote a post where I said, my search for work begins.
And he posted a link to his resume with recommendations on the professional networking site LinkedIn. Now he spends hours each day at his computer, which chirps intermittently with new email and instant messages. He reaches out to everyone he knows for introductions to people they know who might have work for him. Atkins says it's not that different from the search process before social media, but online networking makes it so much easier, he says.
I'm having lots of meetings with people, but now I think the meetings are better because they can read about me, I can read about them online, I can see what they're doing. Sometimes you just really connect with people through a shared interest that wouldn't be obvious from just cold calling them on the phone or just meeting them in person with no context.
According to Diane Darling, who runs a Boston consulting company called Effective Networking, Atkins is going about his job search pretty much the right way.
What I call hybrid networking, and it's where you combine online and offline networking.
Darling says it helps, obviously, that Atkins works in tech. But you'd be surprised, she says. There's a social network for almost anything. If you're an out-of-work welder, try trade associations. Post in neighborhood blogs. Check in with your high school alumni group. But no matter what color your collar, she says, be sure to join the two main social networking websites.
People are going to look at LinkedIn and Facebook, and if you're not there, you're considered irrelevant. It means you're not with the program.
For anybody reluctant to build and maintain an online presence, particularly one that reflects well on you professionally, she says this.
Before Google, there was gossip. And you had no control over who was saying what. Now you can get a little bit of a better sense of what people are saying. And I think it's important that you manage that, your own reputation.
And she says the time to start setting all this up is not when you lose your job, but while you still have one.
Help Dave find work following his layoff, and there's a link to my LinkedIn profile.
For Dave Atkins, the unemployed tech worker, he was already off and running at the first of the year when he got laid off. He says he's seen TV shows about people who lose their jobs and go on pretending there's no problem, even to family. When he lost his, he knew he couldn't afford to do that.
I've got three kids, and my wife is a stay-at-home mom. And we didn't have like months and months of savings in the bank. So it was really, you know, showtime when I was realizing that I need to do stuff. And so I've been, you know, pursuing everything I could and using social media to connect to real people.
Atkins doesn't have a job yet, but through his online contacts, some part-time consulting work came his way. It's been enough income that he has put off claiming unemployment.
That report from Here Now is Kurt Nickisch. Well, quick note, last night there was a break from the bad economic news, the Grammy Awards. Big winners included established artists Alison Krauss and Robert Plant, newcomer Adele, who beat the Obama girls' favorite, the Jonas Brothers, and Coldplay captured Song of the Year for their Viva La Vida, which, come to think of it, is not that far off the headlines. A guy who used to rule the world, seas would rise when he gave the word. Now he sleeps alone, sweeps the streets he used to own. What better anthem for a year that featured fallen CEOs, scam artist real estate moguls, and Bernard Madoff? Up next, Larkin Termite, the novel getting rave reviews, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. You might remember the controversy over No Gun Ri. A 1999 Pulitzer Prize-winning article claimed that during the Korean War, as American soldiers led a column of South Korean civilians fleeing advancing North Korean troops, the South Koreans were strafed by U.S. aircraft looking for infiltrators. And then, when they took refuge in a tunnel under the railroad tracks, they were fired on and killed by another group of American ground troops. A subsequent investigation found there'd been no order to fire. The Americans had just panicked. Well, now author Jane Ann Phillips imagines what might have happened that day at No Gun Ri and how it might have reverberated in a fictional small town in West Virginia in her new novel, Lark and Termite. Lark is a young girl. Her half-brother Termite is severely brain damaged. Their aunt Noni is raising them. While Noni works at the local diner, Lark takes care of Termite, parking him in his chair outside on a steamy July day while she washes the dishes.
Dishwashing doesn't make money, but I like it at home when I'm alone. I'm so used to being with Termite, he feels like alone to me. He's like a hum that always hums, so the edge of where I am is blunt and softened. And when I push the dishes under, I don't even look at them. I keep my eyes on him out the window. Noni said I wasn't graduating high school to be a 17-year-old waitress. She says I don't need a job. Termite's my job, and Barker secretarial when she can be home nights to stay with Termite. The point is to make things better, Noni says. Have a future.
As we discover, Termite's father, Corporal Robert Levitt, was killed at No Gun Ri. Lola, the mother Lark and Termite share, also ultimately becomes a victim of that day. The New York Times' Michiko Kakutani called Lark and Termite incandescent and utterly original, and we would add, it lingers. And author Jane Ann Phillips joins us with more. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's nice to be home.
Oh, yes, and what a read. Why this story? Did you also learn of No Gun Ri in that 1999 Pulitzer Prize-winning article?
Well, actually, I had started writing Lark and Termite about 7 years before that article came to light. Lark was the first voice to come to me in this novel, and she described in her first section of the book who the kids are, where they live, and they play often in this double railroad tunnel.
Right.
And Termite's father, Lark, tells us early in the book, was killed in the Korean War, but they don't know how. So I was very much inside the world of the book when the story broken by Martha Mendoza and her AP team was on the front page of the Times, and there was a big color photograph of this double railroad tunnel that looked exactly like the tunnel I had imagined.
In West Virginia.
In West Virginia. And I looked at the photograph and realized that that was how Levitt had died.
Your fictional Levitt.
My fictional Levitt, who is Termite's father, who is evacuating villages in South Korea, aware, very much aware, that Lola is about to give birth to his son in the States.
So you now had sort of an answer to where your fictional character's father went. And you seemed pulled into the story of No Gun Ri. In fact, the dedication on your book is to several people, including an infant boy who died at No Gun Ri. Who are those people?
There are three children. The infant boy who died at No Gun Ri, according to a list of victims uncovered by the AP, actually died because his mother smothered him so that he wouldn't cry and attract attention to the people in the tunnel. The other two children are children I worked with. One of them is a child I worked with when I was working in a daycare center, a great little girl who had some real physical challenges and a wonderful spirit. And the other is a child of a very close friend from whom I learned a lot. He was born with severe disabilities but seemed to have very intense perceptions and a real joy in everything that he did.
Well, let's give them their due. We have Ailey, 1974-2005, Audrey, and Cho, who again was the infant boy who died in the tunnel at No Gun Ri. And I was going to ask you about, you know, what your personal connection to disabled children might be.
I think the connection really is that writers empathize extremely deeply. I've always been extremely drawn to points of view of children in literature. I think children are the ultimate outlaws. They're characters who see things out of context, who see things always with a kind of Zen mind, you know, beginner's mind. and they redefine for us as readers everything they see.
Well, Audrey, the child that you worked with, do we see some of her in Termite?
There's a little of each of them, I think, in Termite.
Yeah.
Audrey, Ailey, and Cho, of whom, of course, no one ever had the privilege of knowing,
right,
except his mother.
Well, the spine of your story is Corporal Levitt's ordeal at Nogunri in 1950. He's leading a column of refugees. He's worried about possible infiltrators among the refugees. He's worried about his own men, and he's also worried about being strafed by U.S. planes trying to hit infiltrators among the refugees. He's hit and dragged into the tunnel by a Korean woman trying to save him, and then begins this nightmare. How much of this was through your research of Nogunri? I mean, were American troops found in the tunnel?
No, this did not happen, but it could have happened. I mean, in fact, there were American troops escorting these refugees who were strafed by American planes. The refugees then ran into the tunnel for cover. In my story, Levitt is drawn into helping a young Korean girl who is carrying on her back her brother who can't walk. I mean, in many ways, this is a novel of parallel worlds and the connection between one world and another. And the Korean girl and her brother clearly are counterparts for Lark and Termite in West Virginia. And it's a statement, in a way, about the connections between us that are not so obvious but are very strong.
Right. Well, as we watch Corporal Levitt's nightmare unfold in the tunnel, there's also a flood that affects Lark and Termite. Their whole town is flooded, rising waters. They struggle to get to the top floor. What was the flood for you?
Well, the war is a kind of catastrophic, man-made weather that no one can stop. It seems inevitable. It overwhelms everyone in its path. War, once unleashed, is simply uncontrollable, like a hurricane or a flood. So the flood is connected, in a sense, to the sweeping away involved in the war. And this is a story really about relationships that are interrupted by a violent occurrence and the incredible power of human yearning. It's a father and son who never meet, and yet there's this almost intuitive bond between them that's extremely strong.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask you, in addition to writing your own works, you teach, you started the MFA program at Rutgers Newark, and I heard you tell Leon Hansen you had real concern that people just weren't reading. They're not reading the greats. And part of what you did in constructing this program was make sure that people read before they started to write. What would you recommend people read?
Everything. Reading really can help. It almost helps us rehearse life before we live it, the way acting a scene on a stage can help us. And when we read books like War and Peace or Madame Bovary or As I Lay Dying or A Death in the Family, we are learning consciously and unconsciously about the connections between one human and another and one time and another. If we lose that, we're really losing a kind of connection to the past, the present, and the future that we might engage in.
That's Jane Ann Phillips. Her new book is Lark and Termite. Jane, thanks so much for coming to speak to us about it.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.